theme. And you need to go through this cycle with, depending on how senior the participants are, their staff beforehand. Okay? You need to playtest it and playtest it. So you need to be clear about the aim and the purpose of the game. You need to be clear how the output of the game is going to be used and how it will be integrated. You need to think about who is playing the game and the decisions that they'll make. The genius Paddy Griffiths, historian, who came up with the most amazing games, locked a guy in a cupboard one game and literally went in and asked him two things in the entire day. Paddy was a genius, but occasionally his game design was completely arse. But, you know, you have to adjust for someone who's a genius. You need to work out what the freedoms and constraints are. In previous years at Connections, we didn't know how many people's turning up. Is it going to be 50? Is it going to be 100? Your game design has to be able to cope with 50 or 100. How much time have we got? Nowhere near enough time. So we have to ruthlessly simplify our game design. What facilities? We wanted to run a game, but we only had the Safra Lecture Theatre. It's a tiered lecture theatre. How were we going to run a game in that? And the answer was, we had to have the map on the screen, so it was going to be an open game, and we had to have people being able to display their orders from their position in the room. And what materials do we need? And boy, was I busy on the laminating machine making cards that would be able to be held out. And then, of course, we need to work out what the data collection and analysis is. What's the purpose? If we're trying to determine a course of action, if we're trying to work out if we should employ one thing or another, we need evidence for that. And where does that evidence come from in the game, and how do we record that evidence? Now, I've put data collection and analysis at the end of the list because it's a linear list. But you have to design the game for the data collection. And the data collection should be part of the game. Okay? I'll cover more on that later. What are we trying to achieve in that aim and purpose? Games for education tend to be different to games for training. Games for training need to be complete and work. Games for education can be flawed. They can have mistakes in them. Because when the players go, hang on, this is wrong, they then have a violent debate about how they're going to overcome that. And education is taking place. It is often better in an educational game to leave it a little bit half-baked, because you will get a much richer discussion. Here is talking about Belt and Road to the Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies. As you can tell, it's in Hawaii. And they looked at Belt and Road, and because they were slightly nervous, because all of the students from there come from the Pacific Rim. So the two games I was suggesting was Belt and Road and North Korea. In the end, they bit the bullet and they did North Korea, and it went down a storm, and they've been doing it ever since. And there's some really good stuff going on. So we had to work out what's the purpose of the Asia Pacific Institute for Security Studies. It's to get everybody from the Pacific Rim in on a course discussing political issues. So you've got the guy from the Philippines sitting next to the guy from Vietnam talking about real life problems. They get paid to fly over, and they get paid for the course, and it is in Hawaii. So the courses are very well attended. And when they're discussing in a matrix game format how they're going to deal with things, all of those subtext of influence, of cultural issues, all come out. It's a very rich way of doing it. And, you know, something I completely missed when I suggested it, I just thought it'd be cool. They have modified the game to fit what they're doing. Because I have learned that if I put on a game for someone, at the end of it, they say, wow, Tom, that was a fantastic game. That's a failure. Because what they're saying is they don't think they can do it themselves without me being there. Whereas if they say, Tom, that was a fantastic game, but I'd like to change this, or I think there should be another role here, or can we tweak that? Then they're thinking about how it's going to fit in with their particular environment. Because I design games that I like. Most of the time, they're vaguely work in other people's areas, but they're not necessarily made specifically for you. And they need to be. Because I don't know the cultural, political background that is affecting your place of work or what you're trying to achieve. Here's a game. This game was to understand Western approaches tactical unit command. And if you haven't picked up the flyer, wave the flyer. It's in front of you. The flyer. There it is. So if you haven't picked up one of those, please do. The Navy, the Royal Navy, went to Western Approaches Command, and from first principles and a bit of historical investigation, worked out how the game was played. We did it on white paper with a red pen, and they looked through a red filter so you couldn't see the U-boats. I, of course, was a U-boat commander, and here you see the Navy commander, who's here, celebrating slightly, having ruthlessly sunk me for the second time. I have to say, all of the ladies who were there running it did spectacularly well. The naval officers, including the naval attaché from the Canadian embassy, because the Canada had their own version, did very well. And myself and Rex were the U-boat commanders, and it's a privilege to be sunk by them. Here's another design. This one is for Sandhurst. So the guys go out, and they do a tactical exercise without troops. They stand on a hill, and they look across a valley, and in amongst the bushes are a couple of signs which say, this is where the bad guys are. And you're going to do a platoon attack. And the students spend the entire day working out the best way to attack the enemy. The entire day. And then at the end of the day, they came into the classroom, and I split them in half and go, here's a map of the area you've just looked at. Here are some very simple counters. Split in half. Okay, you're the friendly forces. You're the enemy forces. Friendly forces, I need you to work out your route of march and how you're going to get on the map. I'll go over to the red and say, right, these are your orders. Oh, by the way, what would you like in addition to the ORBAT that you've been given? And they look at me and go, what do you mean? And I go, well, when you're playing friendly forces, there was a phase where you said, can we have some extra kit? And you asked for a UAV and you asked for heavy machine guns. You don't think that only applies to the friends. What would you like? Oh, I'd like ballistic missiles. No, you can have a sniper or a UAV. What do you want? But I then go back to the friendly forces and say, right, what's your plan? And the guy goes, my plan is this. And I go, is that the same plan you spent the entire day thinking about? No. Well, why not? They know what the plan is. No, they don't. They've just spent the entire day thinking about it, like you. So what you're really saying is, now that you know that the enemy isn't stupid, you've changed your plan. You don't really need to do the game. It's very, very simple. It used to happen quite a lot. Then one of the DS moved the location of the enemy off the map and they couldn't work out how to print the maps, and they stopped doing it. But such is the way of wargaming. So, how do you develop the game? You need to work out the setting, you need to work out the scenario, you need to decide how you're doing adjudication. Is it going to be a subject matter expert? Is it going to be a combat veteran saying, no, you've lost? Or is it going to be a more objective way of understanding that? What are the processes? And of course, beg pardon, gosh, are those processes including how you will capture the data? And then how are you simulating what is happening in the game? Okay, what processes? You will need to be careful that you don't add extraneous data. You don't make it too complicated. You don't want to add things that are below the decision-making level of the players or above the decision-making level of the players. The purpose is to provide them for meaningful decisions. It's not to get the individual players accounting for every round of ammunition, because commanding officers don't count the rounds fired, I can assure you. You need to work out who the players are going to be. Are they going to be available all day? What sort of players are you going to get? An experiment was carried out by the infantry a while back. The unit that provided the players was actually deployed. So all of the players who turned up were the sick, the lame, the lazy, and those who'd failed their drug tests. You might not get a properly represented result from that game. And then, of course, you need a venue and a nice layout. This room is particularly suited for certain types of games. When we're doing a development, it's important to understand the level of the game, the resolution. Am I going to be fighting at a battle group level? If I'm fighting at a battle group level, I need to make decisions that are appropriate to a battle group staff. So people go, well, you should think two down. So I should think to the companies, and therefore I should think to the platoons. What that says to me is that my game needs to have platoon level resolution. I need to fight platoons against each other. Why don't I fight with individual soldiers? And I go, well, hang on, we've got a battle group. That's 650 men and women. So what am I going to do? I'm going to have 650 little toy soldiers. I've got to move every few minutes. You need to understand the relationship between the level of the game and the resolution. It's very important. The other thing that's important in the development is time and scale. What's the planning cycle for a battle group operation? According to the doctrine, it's 6 to 8 hours. So I plan it, I then execute it. So how long are my game terms? Am I going to have game turns? Am I going to go from critical event to critical event? These are all questions that you need to understand. And in the development phase, they are related to each other. On the professionalwargaming.co.uk website, in the download section, is a little pamphlet written by Jim Wallman, which covers this quite well. Then you need to execute. And the execute, you need a playtest yourself. You need to test the whole system. So you might be testing the combat, you might be testing the movement system, etc. You need to have a complete test exercise and then a full rehearsal before you execute. Those are the minimum, absolutely the minimum. The internal playtest, if you can playtest and playtest and playtest, you should. And you should get people in not like you, because of course I have assumptions about what's reasonable. I have an entire language that relates to game. So if I say to you, what's the probability of success, and I go 10 plus 2 d6, and people understand that who understand games, Other people go, what the hell are you on? Okay? And then, of course, we need to validate our game design. The sponsor needs to be able to say, yes, that's what I asked for, and that's what I got. Working out what the sponsor wants can be very tricky. I ended up at another government department where I was asked, how can we do a game about cyber and introduce it into normal military exercises? I went there and I said, really? Is that what you want? And at the end of the discussion, it was actually they wanted a war game to get their bosses to understand that anything to do with cyber was not concrete or guaranteed. It had nothing to do with the education and training. What they really wanted to do was to try and change the mindset of the bosses from an information gathering regime where precision was the ultimate thing to get to an organization that dealt with cyber, where it's, yeah, we kind of think this is what's going to happen when you press the button, but something else might happen. And that was very difficult. So finding out what they actually want can be tricky. Collect the lessons. We want to validate externally. Did we meet the objectives from the sponsor? But we also need to internally validate, was our game what we wanted it to be? Was it good enough? Findings, recommendations, promulgation and records. Most game reports are there to caveat the results of the game. Most game reports said, ooh, it was a one-off, ooh, because we don't want to overstate the results. The refining bit is an iterative process. You need to go back and check your aim and be ruthless, because it's very easy to go, this looks similar to the last one I did, so I'll use that design because most of it's the same. And then when you go through the process, you realize that because it's very similar, you've fixed it with the last game. And actually, you're missing out a big chunk of what's different. So you have to be ruthless and adjust the aim, confirm the requirements, and then change the process. How do you make it more efficient? How do you validate it? How do you get the psychology right so that people will be engaged in the game? Because it's when people are engaged that you get the maximum use out of it. And of course, write it down so that when you get posted, or when you're an old guy like me and you suddenly go, no, enough's enough, I'm going to retire, people know what on earth you've done. So, sound test game, I've explained it. So we want to encourage maneuverous thinking. It needs to be part of the standard military course. So we're going to have a lecture, my propaganda thing about wargaming. We're going to have the war game, but we're going to need to run it in 10 classes simultaneously. So I've got to train people how to use the game. So these are starting in my mind to think. Now, the game's going to take place on a map. This is the 1 to 50,000 map, and this is the area. Okay? So they go out and they conduct their tute from here, and then they walk around this area, and then they're going to come back into the classroom and they're going to do a war game. So I'm thinking it's going to be a map game, because there's no way I can build a 3D model in the classroom. A map game is actually quite good because they're going to go out and see the terrain, so they can relate the terrain to the map. So the difficulty of having a paper map and visualizing the terrain is overcome because they've got experience with it. Good. So what sort of map do I want? I mean, I can't enlarge that. So what can I do? What's the purpose of the game? Are we conveying knowledge? Are we entertaining? Are we, who's it for? Is it so the commandant looks good? Is it for the directing staff or is it for the students? Who's going to participate? Am I going to participate? What experience and knowledge will they have? Well, one thing's pretty good is that the directing staff at Santa's will have quite a lot of knowledge and combat experience. So if I'm thinking about adjudication, I can probably rely on them being experienced enough to do a free Kriegsspiel. What are my constraints? I'll only have them for 90 minutes at the end of the day after they've been out in the field. So they're going to be a bit tired, so I can't keep them for too long. What are the problems? Well, it's something familiar, unfamiliar. Most of these guys have never done wargaming. Okay? What style of game do I want? Well, I normally start with a map because, of course, when I started in the army, it was, when you consider a problem, ground, situation, mission, the ground comes first. So, do I use a hex map with a stylized terrain? So this is the bit which they stand on and look over the terrain. These are the woods, these are the little hills, and this is where the enemy is. Do I do something like that? It'll make the game much more regular and easy to do, but do you think that's appropriate for Sandhurst? I don't. I think that'll turn people off. It looks so gamey. It's not a sort of military thing. So what I did was I got somebody to produce the contours of the area. Now, I'm very fortunate, I have a terrain guy. These contour intervals are deliberately selected at 2 meters because it's the height of a person. And I put those on a map and I made the background. So it looks more or less like a military map. And then I stuck hexagons on it. And then I thought, but that's a bit of a problem because the hexagons have a very regular structure, which means you can move people around, but that has no relation to how difficult it is to move on the map. These are very steep hills. Moving from here to here, you're running downhill. So actually, the regular grid over the irregular terrain doesn't help me. And besides, it still looks very gamey. How about I just remove the grid completely? And I thought, hey, this would be cool. Because of course, if you're in the game and you want to say, where am I? The guy's going to have to relate where this point is to his paper map in order to give a grid reference. So that's exercising another part of his military training. He's got to estimate where he is based on the terrain and then relate that to his map. I thought that'd be a cool idea. But actually, it's kind of artificial because I'm getting him to estimate from a paper map that's a very accurate drawing. When in actual fact, the skill comes from estimating whether that tree over there is at this grid reference or not. I then thought I could regularize the movement by having little dots at 100 meter intervals. But that's exactly the same problem as the hexagons. I'm just making it look less gamey by having the dots. I still haven't solved the problem that some 100 meter intervals are bloody difficult to walk through and others are easy. And so I finally came back to a map that looks very much like a military map, but instead of having kilometer grid squares, I had 100 meter grid squares. And that's what we ended up with. The DS felt comfortable with that because it looks like a military map. And then of course I had to train them how to do this. So am I going to use a complicated set of rules? Absolutely not. So it's got to be common sense. It's got to be something I can teach, oh, in an hour. Wow, I've got an hour to teach them. How much time did I actually have? It came out about 20 minutes, half an hour. But fine, you can put on a very swift demo. They get the point. It's not rocket science. It's absolutely military common sense. So let's talk about adjudication. Why do we need adjudication? Well, when A fights B, we want to know who won. And we don't want the players going, no, I won, and smacking the other guy in the face. Well, most of the time we don't want that. So how can we do this adjudication? Well, we talked about personal experience. There is, of course, the adjudication of the senior officer present on the assumption that the senior officer present is more intelligent and has more experience than us, which is fundamentally flawed more times than it is true. You could have a military judgment panel. All we're doing there is spreading the blame. It's no more accurate, and we're absolutely getting groupthink because a military judgment panel has a senior officer and two junior officers, and they discuss stuff until the junior officer says what the answer is going to be. We could have rigid adjudication. We could have rules that are specifically written to cover every eventuality and balanced so that the game produces a result that is similar to what we predict from our operational analysis. How fun is that? Not. You know, oh, I need to turn to page 36 to find out what happens if I drop a hand grenade. We can have deterministic resolution. If you attack at 3-1 odds, you will win. If you attack at 2-1 odds, you will suffer losses and you will win. If you attack at 1-1 odds, both sides will suffer losses and withdraw. That will happen every time. That's deterministic. Stochastic is we're going to roll a dice because nothing is certain in war. We could use combat results tables with that encoded in it, so that you look at those and you go, if I attack at 5-1, I will have a better chance of success than if I attack at 4-1. Therefore, I'm going to increase the force ratios to give me a greater chance of success. Or you could get everyone to agree. You'd be surprised. When it comes to a recce battle, and I have a BMP hidden in a wood looking down on a road, and the guy's moving a light recce vehicle down the road, and I get the two guys over and I go, right, you're hiding in the woods looking down at this open road, recce vehicle's going along, why do you think you're going to kill him? Well, he's 300 yards away, I'm shooting him with a 40mm cannon, which is optimized for the target, I've been looking at the road, I have superior optics, you know, I'm definitely going to get him. And then you turn to the other guy and say, why do you think he's not going to get him? And the guy goes, well, I'm driving really fast. And you go, really? That's going to help you survive? No, well, I'm dead. There you go. Or we could go to crowdsourcing as we discussed that. The point is, there are many adjudication methods, and we need to consider what we're trying to do. Agreement amongst players gives us high flexibility, but as we go back to our biases, we're not confident that we will get the same result if we do it again. But of course, it's very easy to design a game that way. Down this end, when we're looking at cause and effect analysis, when we're trying to work out how many helicopters we should have, then we need to have objective criteria. And that leads us down to high confidence because we're only considering a few things. Got to be careful with adjudication. If I'm in an educational environment, I kind of want to end the game just before somebody wins. Because in a classroom environment, I won, therefore the game's fantastic. Or I lost, therefore the game is shy. So it quite often, if you end the game slightly earlier, it's better. Players should do rather than being told. They should experience it. They should discover it. So I want to talk now about the role of chance. Carl von Clausewitz said, right from the start, there is no sure basis in the calculation of war. We can never be certain what's going to happen. From the outset, the play of probabilities, good and bad luck, makes war of all branches of human activity the most like a game of cards. If you're good at it, you reduce your chance of losing. But there's always a chance that it'll go horribly wrong. Very little is certain, it's merely probable. We don't want to try and account for every factor because we can't, and there's no point in doing so. So what we need to consider are a range of results and the probabilities of those. What is the distribution? Now, in quite a lot of cases, the distribution will be a normal distribution. It might be shifted one way or another. Some other distributions are, of course, perfectly possible, but a normal distribution is quite an easy one. The chance that we're talking about represents the risk of success or failure. And actually, rolling the dice can be more accurate than some other methods. We would not have nuclear weapons in the Manhattan Project if they hadn't used the Monte Carlo method. The point about that is you go, what are all the results? We know what the results could be, but what are the chances of each of them? So what you do is you go through the probabilities and roll the dice. And from the observation of that happening over and over again, you can get a very clear understanding of the probabilities, where actually trying to calculate those probabilities mathematically is almost impossible. Although, on my master's course, we specifically do an exercise in which we do that, and one of the students was able to derive it mathematically. but anyway. So Monte Carlo method can actually be more accurate than other methods. So rolling the dice can be. But is it necessary to do that? Games can represent very complex problems, and it may be that it's the decisions of the leaders that are more important than the actual individual outcomes at each point. And there are games that don't involve chance. And here's a couple. Diplomacy. Ending friendships for 30, 40 years. Napoleon's triumph. It has a semi-blind system where you can see where the units are, but you're not sure whether it's a 2 or a 3 unit, and the location and position of the units are all important. It has no dice, and then it's a very effective award-winning game. Both of them are. Now, some people are reluctant to roll dice. I don't want to roll dice. They associate dice with childish games. There's also this thing of, if I roll the dice and I get a double one, and it's a disaster, I'm going to get the blame. This is real. My brigadier in a cyber game rolled a double one, and I had to tell him, yeah, it's a complete failure. Not only that is, you've been identified, and you've burnt your capability, so you can never use it again. You know, everyone burst out laughing, but yeah, he was like, it's your fault. Other people can't differentiate between risk and gambling. The point is, I give you the dice. And I say to you, you need to roll a 10 or more to succeed on 2d6. Okay? So, do you think that's likely or not? Sorry?
No more than any
test. No. Why not? Okay? Now, as a gamer, there's 36 possibilities. A 10 or more is actually, let's have a quick little look. Yeah, you need that's only a 16% chance of success. That's really low. Okay? So you then go, 16% chance, I kind of don't want to risk my life on that one. Because I give you the dice, and then we have this discussion. And then you go, actually, I don't want to do that. I want to delay my attack until tomorrow when I've been reinforced, when I have extra soldiers, when my force ratio is higher, and I improve the odds. And that's what it's supposed to be. But you do get people who go, oh, just roll the dice. They're gambling, and that's not what we want. We want people to understand the odds and make reasonable decisions based on the risk that they represent. Now, when you are doing dice, it's probably a good idea to have dice that are fair. Okay? I have here genuine casino dice. They are spun up in a machine like you would balance your tires to check that they are absolutely fair. They cost like $5 each. They're quite nice. You do get people who go, well, these have got very sharp edges. They're designed to be rolled on bays. If I roll it in a certain way, oh, I can get it to slide it. Okay. Let's not be childish, shall we? You can buy dice that are 5-5-6, 5-5-6, and then the other dice is 1-2-3, 1-2-3. Do I want to roll high on this? I'll get the dice out. Yeah, people do cheat. I mean, it is ridiculous, but they do. The other thing is cultural issues. When I went to China, I thought it would be really cool to come back with some Chinese dice. What I meant was dice with Chinese characters on them. I said, could I get some Chinese dice? And oh my God, it would be as if I'd admitted to my host that I killed the cat in a satanic ritual. The entire atmosphere in the room changed and they all looked at me and I thought, well, what have I done? That's weird. Anyway, about a day later, the young woman who's my minder appeared, checked no one was around, produced a little brown envelope and slid it across and said, there's your dice. And I opened up and they're just normal six-sided dice. Dice are for gambling. It's the National University of Defense Technology in China. Everyone's military. You are absolutely, absolutely not allowed to gamble. So asking for some Chinese dice was a real cultural oops. Oh, I never realized that. That's interesting. They don't do wargaming, do they? Yes. Oh, that's easy. I produced the 10-sided dice and they went, wow, I've never seen anything like that, confirming that they don't do wargaming at the lower level. And then there's weird things about rolling the dice in a fair way. There's a dice tower, so you drop them in the top. I mean, come on. It's ridiculous. The other thing we need to consider is, are we talking about success or failure? Well, yes, we are. But is success or failure binary? Every single special forces operation I've heard brief has a 70% chance of success. Every single one. Why? Because they're not going to do it unless they think they're going to win. Oh, and by the way, Prime Minister, it's not certain that it's going to work. So every special forces operation, unless it's a last dart, whatever, is about 70% chance of success. Letting you know it's risky, okay? But that we've done all the preparation and we think we're going to succeed. But what does success look like in a big operation? Well, there's normal success. Normal success is, I'm a battle group, I've taken a position, and I'm ready to follow your orders and do something else. Culminating success means, yes, I've taken the position, boss, but for God's sake, don't tell me to do anything until I've got more ammunition, reinforcements, and half my vehicles have been repaired. Culminating point, Clausewitzian theory. And then there's unfortunate success. Ah, yes, boss, we took the position. There were twice as many enemy as we thought, but they've all surrendered. So I've now got 1,000 prisoners, and what the hell am I going to do with them? Then, of course, failure. What's common failure? Well, common failure is I kind of went left flanking and got punched in the nose. So I went right flanking and got stopped there. And I was ready to go down the middle, and I kind of ran out of time. So yes, I can attack tomorrow, but I'm sorry I didn't succeed today because the coordination and everything didn't work. Then, of course, straightforward failure. I attacked. I've had too many casualties. I can't attack again until I've been reinforced. And then there's disaster. You know, Operation Eagle Claw in the desert. Sorry, I flew my helicopter into my other helicopter, and everyone's dead. And the commanding officer's dead. So what are we going to do? Success and failure are not binary. Simply having this discussion and assigning probabilities to those things can be really fruitful and bring out an awful lot as part of a war game. And we haven't actually thrown the dice yet. Although I did get one where I produced a 10-sided dice, and one of the guys goes, oh God, we're playing Dungeons and Dragons, are we? So you have to go, well, dice represents risk and all that stuff I've just said. And then you go, it's a 10-sided dice. You wouldn't recognize it unless you've played Dungeons and Dragons. So shut up. Now, how do you incorporate the point that you were making about it's not necessarily a level playing field? How do you add for the advantages and subtract from the disadvantages? One way is to have a basic mechanism with advantages and disadvantages. So the base mechanism is, depending on my training, I will have a value for my shooting. And if I've got the first shot in, I'm at an advantage because I've been waiting to shoot him. And if we're at short range, I've got an advantage. If the target's in cover or moving, you know, whatever. That's one way of looking at it. Or we can have our sample engagement, which I've mentioned. Here I have a recce vehicle hiding in the woods. This recce vehicle is stationary, but of course, I'm hiding in the woods a long way down. This guy's heading down the road, and he's going to be engaged in the flank by this guy. And you simply say to him, why do you think you're going to succeed? And count off the reasons. And then why do you think you're going to still be alive? Because I'm driving at 80 miles an hour. Yeah, right. Well, we'll roll the dice. I'm going to add 4 things for you're moving in the open. The guy shooting you with a weapon optimized for the target. He's prepared for you moving. And your other recce vehicle, which is stationary, cannot give you support. And I'll take one off because of the fact you're driving incredibly fast. So I'm going to add 3 to my dice roll. You have a basic chance of 7 to succeed. If I add 3 to a 7, what does that get me to? 8, 9, 10. So I have a 90% chance of success. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? You get the people to articulate it, and you can come to a conclusion which they'll be happy with. Then they roll the dice. Do they get lucky? Yes, he's lucky. He's driving incredibly fast. Wow. You can have combat results table. Here's an example of one from a game. So basically, at 1-to-1 odds, you've got 50% chance of defender retreating and 50% chance of the attacker retreating. When you get up to this level at 6-1 odds, every, well, basically defender is eliminated under all circumstances. So I must attack at 6-1 odds every time. Actually, this is based on a bit more historical evidence provided by DSTL. So here we have hasty attack versus hasty defense. And if my odds are 1-1, which is here, actually, it's unfavorable. I've got less than a 30% chance of success. Okay. So if there's a normal thing that we should attack at 3-1 odds, well, actually, that gives us a 70% chance of success when we have a prepared attack against a hasty defense. What's the planning timeline for a battle group attack? It's about 8 hours. How long does it take you to dig in? 6 hours? 8 hours? So actually, most of the time, if you spend 8 hours preparing for your attack, by the time you get there, the enemy are going to be in prepared defense, and actually your odds are only 50-50. Something to think about. While you're planning, the enemy will be doing something. Okay. I have 2 6-sided dice. I said you needed a 10 or more. You were happy that that was a low probability. If I said to you, I've got percentage dice, so 2 10-sided dice, one dice is the tens, the other's the unit. So if I roll a 5 and a 6, it's 56. You have an 80% chance of success. What do you need to roll on the dice? Oh, I don't know. I know, because I do this a lot, but actually, you have to explain to people, if you've got an 80% chance of success, you need to roll less than 80. I rolled 86. No. 80 chances of success from your dice that will produce a number between 1 and 100. 80 chances of success, you need to roll under 80. Boy. Does everyone know exactly what I'm talking about? Or are one or two of you like, I'm not sure. There we go. That's the problem. Percentage dice are very good, but every time you roll it, you go, you have an 80% chance of success, which means you must roll less than 80. Or you can convert everything, as I do with my little cheat sheet, into what do you need to roll on 2d6, because everyone understands that. It's an approximation, I know. But come on. You know, it's all an approximation. Do you have a linear distribution? Do you remember we were rolling 10-sided dice for the earlier game? Every number is as likely as another number. I roll 2d6. Number 7 is way more likely than a 12. I kind of like that sort. You can use playing cards for different distributions. You can use event cards to represent chance. You can have result cards, and I'll show a couple in the middle. You can have lookup tables. Your carrier has been hit by a missile. Roll the dice. I roll the 27, I look it up, and oh, it's a hit on the flight deck. You can get a lot in a lookup table, but it takes time. Or, of course, you can have a computer get your Excel RAND function. How random is Excel? It's really good now. It used to be rubbish. And there's a German guy who wrote a report every time the latest version of Excel came out saying how rubbish it was. Until Microsoft hired him to make it better. So anything under a million repetitions, Excel is perfectly good. Okay? Not good enough for anything to do with banking or serious stuff, but good enough for our purposes. So here's my wonderful cheat sheet, which tells me if I get a 10 or more, I've got a 60% chance of success, and the chance of rolling a 10 exactly are 8%. If I want to get 50% on 2d6, I have two colors of dice, a red and a green. Because if I roll a 7 and the red dice is higher, then it's a failure. If I roll a 7 and the green dice is higher, then it's a success. Of course, I can't have both dice the same and roll a 7. Okay, so actually, this normally works for me in nearly all circumstances. Only occasionally you want to do something different. Now, you can have cards to represent the probabilities, and they can be very effective, particularly for things like missile systems. So this card here has quadrants. We have torpedoes, we have air defense systems, we have gun systems, and we have, I can't remember, something else. You then have a thing in the middle. So the card represents 4 or 5 different sets of probabilities. And when you're firing 10 missiles, you can turn the cards over, whack, 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 down the table. And you've got those 10 probabilities, rather than rolling the dice and rolling it again and rolling it again. Can be a very efficient way of doing it. You have to be careful, though, because, of course, I put one card down, so the probability of the next card is different to the first card, because there's one missing from the set, so you need to understand that. The point is, simple models offering useful insight are better than complex models. H.G. Wells, Little Wars, toy soldiers, metal cannons firing matchsticks and little lead pellets. Military officers came up to him and said, we should be using your system rather than the Prussian Kriegsspiel, because a lot of Prussian Kriegsspiel was rigid games. So a cavalry attack that would take 5 minutes in real life would take 45 minutes to adjudicate in the rigid rules. Were you attacking downhill? Were your horses fresh? Were you light cavalry versus heavy cavalry? Was the enemy facing you at an angle, or are you charging them in the rear? You had to work all this out. And the guys would go, it's a cavalry attack, it's obvious. I'm attacking them in the rear, they're going to die. Oh yeah, but. The point was, what are we trying to achieve from our game? And are we trying to have an accurate statistical method, or are we trying to get people to think about why and how? And we had officers turning to H.G. Wells saying, your game of toy soldiers and matchsticks fired the imagination and created more relevant discussion than some of the Prussian Kriegsspiel, which, let's face it, was boring as hell. Okay. Any questions? Five-minute leg stretch.